Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the correlation between animal abuse and domestic violence. Research over the past 15 to 20 years has seen a clear linkage between animal cruelty and domestic abuse. According to my guest today, more and more social service, law enforcement, and animal welfare professionals are aware of this correlation. And my guest and her organization provides training to intervene to help the family, the animal, as well as treat the abuser. The Animal Alliance of Oklahoma will present clinical psychologist Maya Gupta, executive director of the Animals and Society Institute, in a two-day workshop introducing the Institute's Anacare system to Oklahoma, which stresses the seriousness of animal abuse as it relates to domestic violence, animal suffering, and other antisocial behaviors. Anacare works with service professionals to offer interventions for clients who may be abusers, people who have witnessed animal cruelty or been held hostage by the threat of animal cruelty in their home, or traumatized by witnessing animal abuse. Dr. Maya Gupta holds a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Georgia, and her research has focused on applying information about the connections between animal cruelty and domestic violence to enhance batterer typologies and to improve the prediction and prevention of violence in all forms. If you'd like more information about the Anacare seminar, which takes place Friday and Saturday at College Hill Presbyterian Church, you can visit animalallianceok.org. Maya Gupta is my guest today. Maya Gupta, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Rich. Nice to be here.
And this weekend, you'll be focusing on a workshop on Anacare, which your group, Animals and Society Institute, have developed in applying some of the growing body of research on the connections between animal cruelty and domestic violence. First of all, how strong a linkage is there between these two types of abuse?
There's really some pretty compelling evidence about the link between animal abuse and domestic violence. The research in that area is among the strongest of any research connecting animal cruelty to other forms of violent and antisocial behavior. We have a number of studies now indicating that victims of domestic violence experience the abuse of their animals by the perpetrator, and that this can be used to terrify and intimidate every member of that household, including children. Who may be present. We also know that a high percentage of victims who experience the abuse of their pets actually delay seeking safety because of concern about the safety of their animals. And in some cases, that's because they have nowhere to go to bring their animals with them to safety. For example, if their local domestic violence shelter doesn't have a program to accommodate their pets. In other cases, it's because the abuser has actually said, if you try to leave, I'm going to kill your pet. So the pet becomes the pawn to keep the person in that situation. Yeah.
Has this been a long-studied trend, or is this something we've just learned in the last 10 or 15 years or so?
You know, the research is really starting to pick up the pace now. We've had studies on the link between animal cruelty and various forms of violence going back into the 1970s and 1980s, but I would say that both our mental health and criminal justice fields haven't really started to pay attention to that research until now. Now, over the last 20 or so years, I would say that we've had at least a dozen studies looking at specifically the effects on victims of domestic violence, but where we need more research is on programmatic solutions to this work. How do we prevent animal abuse? How do we intervene with abusers? And how do we develop programs for these victims and their animals to keep them all safe? So I think that's really where we need to go next.
Now, if abusers use a family pet as sort of a pawn, have shelters and the like picked up on that and made arrangements so that animals can come with the family to seek shelter?
They're definitely starting to, and it's really exciting to see some of the transformations across the country. Some shelters have developed actual accommodations on site for animals, so that can range from anything as simple as a few kennels in the staff break room all the way to formal custom-built animal housing facilities that oftentimes they've been very successful in doing community fundraising drives to support. And in other places where shelters may not have the ability to keep their animals, the animals of the residents on site, they've partnered with a local organization such as a humane society or a veterinarian or a doggy daycare facility to help provide care for those animals. Part of that is also that the animals that people have that are they're worried about in these situations aren't only dogs and cats and small animals that, you know, fit in your pocket. Sometimes, especially in rural areas, we see victims who have have livestock, horses, goats that they're worried about. And basically any animal that someone cares about can be a target for abuse in these situations.
Have the studies shown that the abusing animals and abusing a loved one or a spouse or family member, does it come from the same sort of spot, if you will?
We think it does. We need a lot more research into what causes violent behavior in general. And our mental health system these days tends to focus more on the behavior itself than on the origins. But I personally think that when we start to be able to unravel the origins of violent behavior, that'll be the real key to figuring out how to intervene effectively and perhaps even prevent it. It's pretty logical, though, to assume that if somebody can be cruel to a human being, they can be cruel to an animal. And especially in these domestic violence situations, when the abusers will tell us, oh, sure, I would strangle the dog just like I would strangle her, then we know that it's a very deliberate tactic to threaten and intimidate the same way as it is with the human abuse.
Now, it seems like we're in a period of time where we're seeing a growing number of animal abuse stories. Certainly, media is picking up on it more, but it seems like, is there any sense that there's a greater sense of incidence of animal abuse, or is it better reporting and more reporting and better publicizing of these events?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is that it's really hard to know for sure. Historically, we haven't had the ability to track animal cruelty crimes on a large scale across the United States, and part of that was because animal cruelty was never included in the Uniform Crime Reporting Program that's run by the FBI, and that's a program where local law enforcement compiles their data on crime incidents, and it's centralized by the FBI, and animal cruelty was never included there. So we've really had a hard time getting a baseline. I tend to agree with you that we seem to be hearing more about it these days, and so it's hard to tell if that is partially just an increase in public awareness of the issue. But the big news is that as of this year, the FBI has made a change to its crime reporting program, and over the next few years, they're going to begin tracking animal cruelty crimes, so we'll start to have some data available, and I think that'll be great for our system to know.
As you were speaking, I just remember as I was growing up, you know, I grew up in a relatively rural area, and, you know, there were people who treated their animals really well, and there are other people who didn't treat them well, and it was almost considered, well, those animals are his property. He or she can do with them as they please, as long as they're not outright, you know, physically abusing them. But mm-hmm. you know, I think there was a reluctance to get involved in, say, an owner in his animals.
There's such a parallel between the history and evolution of animal cruelty laws and views on animal cruelty and the history of laws and views on such issues
as spousal abuse.
Absolutely, and the idea that someone's wife and or children were his property goes back quite a ways, and it's only through changing some of those societal attitudes and the laws that come out of them that we've made headway for women and children. So I think that the laws that protect animals are following in the same path, just a few years behind those for women and children. But it again serves for me to reinforce the connections between these issues.
A moment ago, you were talking about the fact that a pet or an animal that a family cares for in an abused household may not necessarily be a dog or a cat or a guinea pig or a gerbil. It could be, you know, it could be horses, it could be cattle, it could be pigs, it could be some sort of animal that's raised for agricultural purposes. And a lot of times what we're seeing now, it seems like there's an awful lot of animal neglect, abuse issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this comes from the same place as those who would actually physically abuse an animal to harm it. Is it the same sort of abuse? Does it fit into this correlation between animal and domestic abuse?
Well, we've certainly seen many cases where there is domestic abuse going on and the animals are neglected. So I don't want to paint all the situations with a broad brush because I think we need more research to identify whether there may in fact be subtypes of animal neglect based on the motivation of the abuser. But I can tell you that in so many domestic violence cases I've seen, the animals were neglected, again, as part of the dynamic of power and control. So, for example, the abuser might say to the victim, you cannot buy pet food and you cannot take this animal to the vet that requires treatment. So when I worked with a program that provided assistance to domestic violence victims with their animals, many, many of the cases we saw were not the typical kinds of injuries you'd expect, you know, kicking, beating, that sort of thing, but rather animals coming in with heartworm, with fleas, with basic conditions, malnutrition, related to just not being provided proper care. And especially because in domestic violence situations, abusers are so often controlling the finances of the victim and controlling the victim in other ways, it becomes a very effective way to, again, make the victim suffer. Now, I do think that there are other forms of neglect or other cases of neglect, perhaps especially those outside of domestic violence, where it comes less out of deliberate intent and more out of perhaps lack of understanding of the needs of an animal or understanding, but other circumstances that interfere with caring for that animal. And I think that perhaps those situations warrant a different type of response. Not that we should treat them less seriously, because suffering to the animal in the end is, after all, the same, but perhaps a different type of response in terms of understanding why it's happened and how we go about intervening with the abuser.
My guest today is Maya Gupta, Executive Director of the Animals and Society Institute. She'll be a guest of the Oklahoma Alliance for Animals and Anticare of Oklahoma, which is a new organization, and she'll be hosting a workshop on Anticare, which comes out of the Animals and Society Institute, on interventions on animal abuse, this Friday and Saturday at College Hill Presbyterian Church, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. What is Anticare exactly?
Well, we started Anticare based on the idea that we didn't know much about animal abuse. Again, the studies were growing, but we didn't know enough about what made people tick. And so what we started trying to do was to get clinicians to really do a thorough assessment of their clients' relationships with animals. And that could be in the type of situation where a therapist or psychologist may have a case referred through the court system where somebody has been convicted of cruelty to animals and the judge is interested in having a psychological evaluation. Or it could be another type of situation where perhaps a therapist is just working with a client and the issue of animal cruelty hasn't even surfaced, but we are trying to spread the message that it's important to know what relationships that client may have had with animals, both positive or negative, in his or her life, because so often that can tell you so much more about the person you're working with. For example, someone may not have abused animals themselves, but may have witnessed animal abuse, either as a child or adult, perhaps even in the context of a domestic violence situation. So if you're working with somebody with a trauma history, the animal abuse and the impact of witnessing that abuse can be a really important factor. And then at the same time, we also want to ask clinicians to look at positive relationships with animals, because we have a really strong body of evidence that's starting to indicate that healthy relationships with animals, both in children and in adults, can have a variety of beneficial effects, everything from stress buffers, effects on human health, people living longer, children's social and emotional development. So we really try to work with clinicians in the Anticare model to help them understand how to get this information about their clients' relationships with animals along the whole spectrum from negative to positive, and then use that information to determine ways to intervene that are based on classic principles of behavior intervention with other types of behaviors.
So give us a sense of what those interventions might be.
For example, one of the classic forms of therapy that's used very often to address behavior is called cognitive behavior therapy, and it involves working with a client to understand how that client's thinking influences his or her behavior. And there are a number of situations where, let's say, a child is harming an animal, perhaps tying balloons to a dog's tail, and the parents are concerned about this behavior. We talk to the child and we find out that the child has perhaps some attention deficit hyperactivity disorder going on and is having trouble managing frustration and managing his or her energy. And we work with the child. Of course, we're working with the parents and with others involved, perhaps teachers, other adults involved with the child, and the whole family system. But we work with the child to think about, well, what is it about being frustrated that makes me take it out on the dog? Is it because I am mad because when the dog doesn't do what she should, maybe she makes a mess on the floor, I get blamed for it. You know, others in the family blame me for it. And maybe we want to certainly work with the family to look at the patterns of discipline and expectations about the child and the relationship to the dog. But we might also work with the child on how to not take those frustrations out on the dog. Maybe there's a healthier outlet. Maybe I could go run around the block instead, and then I wouldn't be so mad at the dog and I wouldn't feel so frustrated anymore. So basically, we're just taking principles that we would use to work with children and adults in other settings and saying, how do we use this to change the animal abuse behavior?
Now, I was reading something that says one intervention can be is actually from a person that has a negative relationship and has abused animals to actually trying to get them into a situation where they use the animals as a positive element, sort of creating a nurturing relationship. Is that something that Anacare does?
Well, Anacare is different from some of the therapies that actually formally incorporate animals. Those are called animal-assisted therapies or sometimes broadly animal-assisted interventions. But many of the therapists who come and take our Anacare trainings are also involved with doing animal-assisted therapies, and we think that there may be a natural fit there. Of course, we always want to be careful about how much access we allow somebody who has harmed an animal to other animals, just making sure that any animals we would use in that therapy setting are safe. But there is a really interesting concept there in the transformation from somebody who has perhaps harmed animals out of not having loving bonds with other individuals or other animals to learning that sort of loving bond and attachment and empathy through positive interactions with another living creature. So I think that there's more work to be done in the area, but it's very promising.
Now, are there differences in how you treat, say, a juvenile who's abused an animal as opposed to an adult? Are there different ranges of interventions and therapies that you work with?
The interventions can be very similar. For example, if you're dealing with trauma, then you might deal with that very similarly with both a child or an adult. But in some cases, working with adults is more about helping that adult take accountability and responsibility for his or her actions toward the animal. We use a little bit more the model that we might use with, again, domestic violence perpetrators. Whereas sometimes with children, there's more of a process of education and development because that child is still developing socially and emotionally and cognitively. So it really just depends on figuring out the motivation for the abuse behavior in each case and applying the appropriate intervention. Certainly sometimes with older children, adolescents, you may treat them more like adults because you do get adolescents referred, especially through the criminal justice system, who are savvy to the system. They don't want to be there in treatment. You know, the judge or perhaps their parent or guardian is making them come to therapy, and they don't see anything wrong with their behavior. So then the focus really becomes helping them understand why animal cruelty is wrong, not only because it's a crime in all 50 states, but also because of the other effects that it has.
Now, the opening session of your workshop on Friday will really be devoted to law enforcement professionals, mental health professionals, animal welfare professionals. How aware would you say most of those groups are of this sort of correlation between animal cruelty and domestic violence? Is this something that they're highly aware of? Some are, some aren't. What would you say in most jurisdictions?
I would say that we're getting there, but that certainly still some are and some aren't. And a lot of it seems to have to do with whether that individual had exposure to this topic personally in his or her life. I'm helping to teach a class of almost 40 veterinarians this semester through the University of Florida's Veterinary Forensic Sciences program. And even a majority of those veterinarians say that they hadn't had exposure to the link between animal abuse and other forms of violence. So I think that unless one has seen it personally, one can perhaps even have seen situations professionally where this was going on but not recognize the connection, that link for what it was. And so I think that turning on that light bulb of awareness, that's one of my favorite pieces of doing this work, is to help people see those connections. And not only to see them, but to think about how they can use that link to enhance their own work. And, you know, let's say this is a human services professional. maybe not even someone who loves animals or is focused on animals in day-to-day life, but helping that person see that by paying attention to animals and animal abuse, we may actually be able to help more families or help families that we might not even have been able to reach. And that's where sometimes the real richness here can come from cross-training human services and animal welfare professionals to have good relationships between their agencies and to cross-report cases to each other when the law permits them to do so, so that they can really work together to develop a coordinated community response to violence in all its forms.
A couple times during our conversation, you mentioned trauma, which I assume is witnessing animal cruelty. How does this differ from, say, the attitude and actions of an actual abuser?
Well, we do think that in the growing literature on what's called adverse childhood experiences, witnessing animal abuse can be a form of trauma. We also think that there can be a connection between those who witness animal abuse, especially early in life, and then who become perpetrators of animal abuse themselves. Certainly, in some of the domestic violence cases I've worked with, we've seen children who abuse animals perhaps to act out the violence that they've experienced at home, either that they've witnessed between their parents or that they've witnessed against their animals. We've even seen children who will try to harm or kill their own animals as a way to protect them, to give them a merciful death, if you will, because they know that otherwise somebody else is going to do that job for them and do it less kindly. So we do think there's a connection between trauma and perpetrating abuse, but that's not to say that everybody who harms an animal or everybody who harms a human, for that matter, always has a traumatic background. Some do, some don't. And humans are such complex creatures that we know that sometimes buffers like resiliency can really make a difference, even in someone that has the most horrible of backgrounds, that they may turn out okay. And it's hard to know all the factors that go into that.
My guest today is Maya Gupta. She's the executive director of the Animals and Society Institute. She'll be leading a workshop on Anacare for the Oklahoma Alliance for Animals and Anacare of Oklahoma in a seminar titled Stopping Animal Abuse, which will take place Friday and Saturday at College Hill Presbyterian Church. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, besides doing Anacare, tell us a little bit about the Animals and Society Institute. You're doing everything from looking at urban environments for animals to all sorts of public policy issues, and give us a sort of a range of what animals and society do.
Well, we're a small organization, but we try to do a lot because we realize the broad scope of issues pertaining to humans and animals. So basically, we cover the whole range of how animals and human society interconnect. And so that's everything from how individuals treat animals, like in the animal cruelty work we've been discussing, to broader issues of social and public policy. A good example would, for example, be urban wildlife. How do we deal with problems caused by, let's say, raccoons or other species that interrelate with humans in urban environments? And so what we try to do in all those cases is take a very scientific approach to this issue. You know, animal welfare is something that causes very strong emotions in people, especially in people who want to protect animals, but also sometimes in people who don't care for animals and think that the animal advocates are a bunch of nuts. And so sometimes it's really hard to, you know, walk that divide between the two. There's also, of course, competition for funding and attention between animal groups and human services groups. And sometimes you even start to get into the argument of which species is more important, humans or animals. So what we try to do is actually steer clear of all of that and take a very scientific approach and say, well, what do the data tell us? So, for example, with a policy issue like urban wildlife, we'll collect the studies that are out there, and we will try to look at the best available evidence to make policy recommendations that are data-driven. And more than that, we'll try to put them together into a format that the average member of the public can easily digest and use. We don't see any point in research remaining hidden inside the ivory tower. We think that some of the great work that's going on these issues needs to get out into the public where it can be used for good. So that's really the work that we do across a broad range of issues. And then the other piece that we really try to focus on is encouraging the development of what we call human-animal studies programs in colleges and universities, where we have individuals studying a wide range of topics pertaining to humans and animals, trying to get interdisciplinary curricula and perhaps even degree programs started to help more scientists, researchers, and thinkers explore these issues.
I was listening to your answer about urban wildlife, and of course, you know, it's great having a raccoon in the neighborhood unless he's nesting in your attic.
Right. Yeah.
So at that point, it becomes a nuisance issue. And so what is sort of the mediation between, say, I got to get rid of these raccoons in my attic, but I want raccoons in the neighborhood, or I want wildlife in the neighborhood?
Absolutely. Well, that's a good example of one of the issues where you have to look at all the different sides. So, you know, from the standpoint of humans, sometimes simply just getting rid of all the raccoons might seem to be the immediate solution. And then from the extreme animal side, we want to save every last raccoon and, you know, don't want to see any harm come to them. And sometimes the answer is somewhere in the middle when you look at all the data. Perhaps if we remove all the raccoons, or if we remove all the feral cats, for that matter, we'll have other animals that come in that are also unwanted because the raccoons or the feral cats were, you know, keeping other pest populations at bay. And so it really is oftentimes not a simple solution when you're trying to balance the needs of humans with the needs of wildlife or other animals. But what we try to do is find the one that works the best for everyone involved. And I would say that it's amazing how many times we find that in helping animals, we help people, and vice versa. And coming back to the issue of domestic violence, that's certainly a case where that's true, because we find that when we help provide safety for animals in domestic violence, more of their families are willing to seek safety and go to domestic violence shelters. So we really see a connection in so many cases, both with companion animals and other types of human-animal interactions, between the well-being of humans and animals. We all live on the same planet, after all.
Now, a portion of the workshop this weekend will be devoted towards professionals, clinical professionals, and law enforcement and the like. But what are some of the takeaways you hope the general public who will be coming to, say, some of the Saturday sessions will take away from this?
Well, what I would really like the average member of the general public to take away from this is, first of all, a more sophisticated understanding of the connections between animal abuse and other forms of violence. Sometimes, as we talked about in our growing awareness of animal abuse, sometimes we want to label every animal abuser a serial killer. You know, there's a red flag murderer in training. And the data just don't tell us that that's true of everybody. So what we want to do is help everyone understand a little bit more that, yes, animal cruelty is serious no matter what, but what we really want to do is make sure we look at each case and not treat every case the same. And then the other thing that I think is really important is for everyone to understand the role that they can play in addressing animal cruelty and its connection to other forms of violence in their community. This is not just an issue that touches mental health, law enforcement, our judicial system. It also touches everyone.
Maya Gupta, appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Maya Gupta is the Executive Director of the Animals and Society Institute. The Oklahoma Alliance for Animals and Anacare of Oklahoma will host a workshop on Anacare on animal abuse this Friday and Saturday at College Hill Presbyterian Church, located at 712 South Columbia Avenue. If you'd like more information about the seminar, visit animalallianceok.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.